This is AFRTS Television, Channel 8, in Kodiak, Alaska. The program usually seen at this time will not be seen tonight, in order that we may bring you the following special program. Join us again next week at the same time for Shindig. Ladies and gentlemen, Chaplain W.R. Samuel, Protestant Chaplain of the Naval Station in Kodiak. Chaplain Samuel.
Thank you and good evening. In the last 30 hours, for those of us at Kodiak who have had the opportunity of spending from 7 to 8 hours at the feet of the one who will speak to us this evening, I found that we have been stimulated, challenged, inspired, perhaps goaded, and also blessed. Those of you from town that have also been able to participate in the presentations for the last 30 hours have also felt that you too have received as we have here. The one who is our guest this evening and has been our guest aboard the Naval Station for this last day and a half has been a professor of religion, of education, and the chairman of the Department of Practical Theology at Concordia Seminary in St. Louis, Missouri. He teaches courses in principles and methods of Christian education, administration of religious education, the campus ministry, reaching the educated adult, and theology and modern literature. He has been at Concordia Seminary since 1959. He received his baccalaureate degree from Concordia Seminary in 1945, and then his Bachelor of Divinity in 1947. He also received a Master of Arts from the University of Michigan in 1946, and his Doctor of Philosophy from the University of California at Berkeley in 1957. While he was in Berkeley doing some of his study and subsequent to that time, he was campus pastor for the Lutheran Church of the Missouri Synod. He has been very active around the United States and now outside of the country in speaking to many groups. He's also been a visiting lecturer, associate professor of education at the University of Missouri in St. Louis. Dr. Deffner is with us this evening, and it gives me a great deal of pleasure to introduce him to you at this time. And Doctor, I'm going to ask you the question that you are going to ask us. Who are you? Can you answer this?
That's the question, isn't it? Who are you? Do you remember one of the old Loretta Young television shows when she was a woman psychologist? And she was going around trying to find out how different people thought of themselves, their self-perception. And she asked one basic, simple question. Who are you? One man thought for a moment, pushed himself back from his desk, and he said, I'm a guy being divorced by his wife. One woman thought for a moment and said, I'm a gal with 7 kids. One person said, I'm just a truck driver. One person said, are you a private investigator or something? This is really the question of life, isn't it? Who are you? Are you just a bundle of drives, pretty strong right now, but gradually fading away as you get older, until when the casket is closed, it means no more than bacterial disintegration? Are you just a blob of protoplasm on a speck of dust called the Earth, here in the sea of space, and you can't know who you are or where you are going, and you're slated for annihilation only God knows when some madman pushes the panic button and blows us all to smithereens? Who are you? Why, don't you know? Don't you remember not too long ago when the father called us aside up in the home palace and said, my child, out in the sea of space, I have an island. I'm about to send you out there for a while. Now, this won't be a vacation because I have work for you to do. I want you to take some of the peace and love and truth and justice from the home kingdom to that island. Now, when you get there, many of my other sons and daughters, your brothers and sisters, who have forgotten all about me, will tell you it doesn't make any difference what you do. But remember, it does make a great deal of difference to me. And wherever you are, whether you're in the military, a businessman, a homemaker, a farmer, there in that niche in my vineyard, you are to remind others of who they are, where they came from. You are to tell them of my truth, my peace, and my justice. Now, not all will be happiness on this island. Long ago, sin came into this island and brought with it pain and suffering and sorrow and death and rebellion. And you cannot escape some of the contagion of that rebellion. But long ago I also visited this planet, and I conquered these foes of man. And because of this, you can live a daily happy life. Now one day, I won't tell you when, I will usher you up to a door, and on the door will be a simple sign, death. But don't be afraid, because I'll be right on the other side, and I will take you by the hand, and I will lead you safely across. Meanwhile, my peace I give unto you. So here we are on this island colony, but we have three monkeys on our back: anxiety, guilt, and hate. And there are different ways that people try to handle these problems, different ways that people live on this island colony, as we've intimated here. The mood of many a person is, and how am I to face the odds of man's bedevilment and God's? I, a stranger and afraid, in a world I never made. A young sailor comes into the chaplain's office and says, "Chaplain, if I had the choice between existence and non-existence, I would choose non-existence. I didn't ask to be born." A soldier with no zest for fighting, a writer with no zeal for writing, an architect without a plan, the prototype of modern man. Someone has said that you really have four selves. First of all, there is the self, which is the real inner you, known only to you and to God. Then there is yourself, which is your mask to the world. And other people often don't get behind it to really find out the real you. Then there is the self that you would like to be. And finally, there is the self that you ought to be. And many of the critics of the church today are saying, all I hear preachers talking about is do this, don't do that, you ought to do this, you ought to do that. Like the one man who went all the way across the lower 48 and said, I think I can sum up all the sermons I've heard in one word, may I suggest that you be good. But the perceptive novelist and dramatist of our day, the poet, the playwright, this person really speaks to the inner me, says the critic of the church. Among some 100 or more books that have come out in the last 10 years on the relationship of theology to modern literature is one typical one by William Mueller, who says in The Prophetic Voice in Modern Fiction, we find man's condition nowhere more expertly diagnosed than in the pages of the most perceptive novelists of our time. The story of our age is told most precisely and most eloquently in its imaginative literature. And if much of that literature points to the absence of man's encounter with God, it also points to the human situation which makes such an encounter so rare. We should not infer from so strong a claim that modern man in search of himself and of God can now lay aside his Bible and confidently turn for the revelatory and redeeming word to James Joyce or Albert Camus. But the serious student of modern fiction may discover that his reading eventuates in a self-knowledge alerting him to biblical affirmations previously unnoticed. The novelist will not save us, but he may well bring us to the knowledge that we are in need of salvation. In other words, someone has said that many of the writers of our day, otherwise called the merchants of despair or the futilitarians, are people who are in effect saying that society, man as a whole, is like a group of men in a ship at sea. They've bashed in the bulkhead, opened the petcock, knocked down the mast. They're losing their lives. They're wailing their lament of despair. And they insist that everybody else get into the same boat with them. As Tennessee Williams said when somebody asked him, Tennessee, what are you trying to say in your plays? And he said, what I'm trying to say is, help, help. Now, as we look at great literature, good lasting literature, we might speak of various prototypes or images or portraits of man that come out. The same would be true of television that you and I watch, or plays that we see. And in these various works, we see modern man more or less as he really is. We may get too bestial a picture of man, this is true. Some would say this of Tennessee Williams' plays. Or we might get too optimistic a view of man, only fallen a little bit from grace. The amazing thing also, though, is that we see something of ourselves here. This can help us in understanding and knowing who we are. The types that I'm going to speak of briefly here are not clear-cut. They interplay and merge with each other. Some of the books I'm going to refer to are great. Some are not so great. I'm not saying that you can all go home now and read Baby Doll with the church's approval. Let's look at some of these images of man briefly. Who are you? Are you the man, the woman of complacency? You can see the portrait of this person in the works of John O'Hara, Sloane Wilson, John McPartin, many others today. This is the person who lives in a mental imaginary house of security. Here is the family room, anything for the kids. Here's the room of the job, the corporation has the man's soul. Here's the bedroom for sleep. Here is the living room for status. But this life of complacency, the life of materialistic man today, is undergirded by only two matchstick props, status and money. And you take one of these two props away and the entire structure crumbles and falls. And then we find that from behind this facade of complacency comes out the man of despair or the man of defiance, like Gregory Peck in Man in a Gray Flannel Suit. When his wife discovered his infidelity, he came rasping out of his shell like a wounded adolescent, saying, sure, I killed 17 Germans in Italy during the war. Sure, I fathered this illegitimate child with Maria, but don't read me lectures. I'm doing the best I can with life as I see it. Determinism. Man is a pawn of forces beyond his own control. Or you get this from Judge Dealey in By Love Possessed. Things have been fixing for a long time when you come into the game and there's not much you can do about it, and that means you too. But while this life is a-going, it's a pretty good life. This is the life of exchanging gadgets for God. These are the people who are not looking for the city of God coming down from the skies, but for a vast conjuring trick coming up from the mines and the factories. A paradise of layer cake houses and clothing made of soybeans and skyscrapers made of glass and automobiles shaped like eggs. We don't need any day of the Lord. Generous Electric and General Motors will take care of all of our needs. Thank you. It's summed up in The Ecstasy of Mr. Price, a little poem by Morris Bishop. Mr. Price has assumed the fetal position, huddled, snuggled on the driver's seat. He touches his key to the ignition to feel the great loving motor beat. In the upholstered womb, he has found security. He's fled from the world's windy woes away. Oh, cradling wash of bliss and lost purity, almighty, all-motor mother, oh, Chevrolet. You don't need people anymore if you have machines. And many of us get our values from machines, as it were, rather from the places we used to, in the synagogue, the temple, the church. The mass media have become the source of our values to a great extent. Some psychiatrists have very seriously examined the almost biblical, liturgical, theological theme that comes through, particularly in the adult Western. And the story always goes something like this. There's this family, see, in Boston, who don't want to lead the life of following the pattern, the organization man. Put on your radar set, dig the latest gimmick, fall right in line. And so they sell their place in Boston. And they come out west, of course, to Alaska. Everything is fine here. They have this ranch and all is well until it's discovered that there's a gold mine on the ranch. And then the trouble begins. The bad guys, the forces of evil, begin to harass these people. And these people don't want to take the law into their own hands, but the established church, I mean the sheriff and deputy sheriff in town, aren't giving these people any help. And so finally these people decide to take the law into their own hands. They arm themselves with guns. They arm the kids with guns. They arm the cows with guns. Everybody on the ranch is armed with guns. And at this precise point in the story, what should happen but across the moor comes a strange, handsome figure all dressed in white and on a white horse. He's masked. And the people are suspicious of him, as are the established authorities. They ask him for a sign. He gives them a silver bullet. He has a minority figure with him, Tonto. And as the story progresses, we find that the forces of evil have the forces of good bound up deep in the bowels of the earth. Here's the dynamite keg over here. The fuse is sputtering away closer and closer. When all of a sudden there's a bursting of the bonds, the forces of good come out of the earth. Over here are the bad guys sitting around the campfire. The good guys get the drop on them. The people get back their gold mine. Good conquers evil. And as Rossini comes up in the background, everybody recites their creed. I believe in law and order, maker of peace and happiness. And in the Lone Ranger, its truest exponent, conceived in nobility, born of mystery, was shunned by society in general, beaten by robbers, buried in apparent death. But 3 seconds later, he arose again to prominence and lives and fights as the right hand of law and order. And I believe in faithful Tonto. I belong to the fan club sharing TV and box tops. I wish life could be like that for me from 1 week to the next. Hi-ho. Are you the man, the woman of complacency? Who are you? Are you the man of despair? We see this in the character in James Gould Cousin's novel, By Love Possessed. Close to Helen's consciousness, nearly impinging upon it, was the forbidden horror, the dreadful, eyeless face of our existence. In a desperation, Helen pushed back the horror, tried not to look. Instead, she tried to impose with all of her strength the kind of a world that she wanted, a place of peace, of order, of good and gentle people who once believed into existence could alleviate Helen's recurrent anguish of trying not to know, yet always knowing that in the midst of life, we are in death. We see this allegory of man coming through in the great work of Franz Kafka. The Trial, did you see the movie? Tony Perkins played in it. A man is hauled out of his room in the middle of the night. He's brought before the bar of justice. He knows he's guilty, but he doesn't know what he's guilty of. Or in The Castle. A surveyor goes to a small village high in the mountains. He's supposed to go to this castle to perform some task. He dies before he ever learns how to get to the castle or what he was supposed to do. This, say the readers, is an allegory, a picture of man. We are forever left waiting for Godot. God is not going to come today. In fact, he will never come. And so we despair. You see this picture in Jean-Paul Sartre's chilling, nihilistic little play, No Exit, where three people, their eyes forever open, have to live with each other forever. Garçon, coward, there are bullet holes in his chest. Inez killed her own child, Estelle, a person who scratched and clawed everybody else around her during her life. And here they are, forever with each other, and they finally make the discovery. There's no need for red-hot pokers. Hell is other people. So here we are forever. My God, how funny. Forever. And these things speak to people today. The moods of the modern artist, the poet, the writer, strike chords in those who are only the man, the woman of despair. Dear Abby, I'm 16 and nothing I do is right. My mother criticizes everything I do. I would do anything to get away from this house and her. There's a sailor I know who's leaving for San Diego soon. He says if I marry him, he will take me away from my unhappy home life. I hate to quit school, but anything is better than living here. Please help me decide. Fed up. Dear Fed Up, stay home. We see this picture in William Inge's The Dark at the Top of the Stairs, where the mother asks the little boy, why don't you want to go up the stairway? And he says, because you can't see ahead. Or do you remember Frederick March playing Willie Loman in Death of a Salesman by Arthur Miller? What a character Willie was, a guy who wanted to be loved, accepted as he was. He felt he had to wow his family to be loved. Only one time there was a glimmer of hope for poor Willie. His one son said, Dad, you don't have to put on all this stuff. And the father said, did you hear that? Biff, he likes me. But Willie went on into the night in suicide so his family could collect $20,000 on the life insurance policy. And then came the funeral. The expected crowds did not appear. The wife comes forward and places some flowers on the casket. Willie, I paid the last payment on the house today, Willie. Willie, why did you do it? And then she says to one of the sons, you know, all he needed was just a little more salary. And the one son says, no, he never knew who he was. This is the epitaph of many a man, the man of despair. It's the prodigal son story really all over again. Badness, sadness, and gladness. He caviled, he traveled, and he reveled. He went to the dogs, he lost his togs, and he ate with the hogs. He received the seal, he ate the meal, and he danced the reel. The tragedy is that so many people stay in the barnyard and don't go back to the waiting father. Are you the man, the woman of despair? Or are you perhaps the man of defiance? We see this character in Burt Lancaster's playing the role in From Here to Eternity by James Jones. I'm a guy that can drink anybody else under the table. I fight. I use women as means to an end. I'm a pretty tough guy, but at least I'm honest about it. We see it in Paul Newman playing in any number of Tennessee Williams plays. Or perhaps many of our youth may see it in Holden Caulfield, in Salinger's Catcher in the Rye. But is all that we are seeing in Catcher in the Rye a picture of an angry young man rebelling against everyone, saying, everybody's a fraud, everybody's a phony, everybody's a hypocrite, especially those preachers with their Holy Joe voices. Some analysts of this book, which, no matter what you think of it, has sold up to the 15 millions of copies, does this somehow reflect the moods of our youth? Some analysts say that Holden Caulfield, like many of the college students of our day, not just the 1% who are the great unwashed, these young people are really not just rebelling classically against their parents, their elders, their national leaders, but are really calling upon us to live up to our own morals, our own mores, and our own ideals. Are you just the man of defiance? Or are you perhaps the man, the woman of nothingness? This is a person increasingly and chillingly among us. Did you read in the Seattle paper tonight of the man who came upon an accident where a man was burning to death in a car, and other people just stood around and he tried to get a fire extinguisher to put the fire out, but the man died before his eyes? These are the people who are totally disenchanted. No commitment, no involvement. The faceless man of nothing of today. The 43 people who watched as the young woman was stabbed in New York some months ago and then finally died in her own blood on the sidewalk. The people in Florida who watched as an elderly pastor and his wife, formerly a missionary to India, was bumped off the canal road by a drunk into the canal. Into only 20 feet of water, the car sank, and the people stood there and did nothing. And the policeman who came cursed them for their nothingness. Father Walter Burghardt, reacting to Vatican II, said, this person committed to nothing is a frightening phenomenon of our time. It is an attitude towards reality that stems from at least four sources. A creeping collectivism where the people suppresses the individual. A growing dehumanization, symbolized by Dachau, the mushroom cloud, and the sheltered doorway. An increasing automation, represented by the IBM card. And as one student at the University of California said, the only way you can get any attention around here is to wrinkle or spindle your IBM card. And finally, the apparent failure of organized religion to redeem the world. In this attitude, man's dignity and his hope lie in his ability to confront with courage and indeed with joy a life and a reality that is senseless, useless, absurd. Man is alone, isolated, a stranger to himself, to the world, to God. But the hell of Sartre, hell is other people, has given place to the hell of Bergman, the film producer. Hell is being alone. This nothing, unexpectedly, does not lead to despair. Perhaps you read the book, Zorba the Greek, or saw the movie, Anthony Quinn played in it. The author, Nikos Kazantzakis, preluded our present epoch some years ago when he wrote in a letter the following frightening lines. In man's world, the success or defeat of the spirit depends on man himself. And the upward path is one of unceasing, ruthless, and bloody strife. To a man who erects his home on the abyss, this challenge does not lead to despair or suicide, but to acceptance of necessity in joy, to laughter on the highest peaks of existence, and finally to a creative play with tragic elements in an ecstasy of joy. And this is just one step away from the man of the new humanism. Are you the man, the woman, of a renewed faith in man, this irrational faith, which says at this point in the world's history, when we can look back over many years, we can see a Tamerlane who in 1215 piled 90,000 heads outside a city gate. We can think of a Genghis Khan, a Hitler, a Mussolini, an Eichmann, and there are those who still say, I have faith in man, that man without God will be able to solve this trilogy of problems, anxiety and guilt and hate. We see this in the words of Albert Camus, who said in his Nobel Prize acceptance speech, I believe I conceive of a measure of the greatness of Christianity. However, if there are those of you for whom Jesus Christ died, there are those of us for whom he did not die. Nevertheless, in the lowest depths of our nihilism, we strive to rise above it. And whereas I will have nothing to do with God and nothing to do with hope, I am not resigned to do without man. Are you the man, the woman of the new humanism? In one sense, I would submit that we can sum up all of these philosophies of the day of which I have been speaking in the what somebody has called the philosophy of the I. If you were to take all the popular hit records and tunes of our day, one has said, and pop them into a capsule under Expo 67 and come back in 2,000 years, the analysts of that day would say that generation must have been the generation who believed in the philosophy of the I. Listen to their prophetic voices as they croon, I need you, I miss you, I love you, I want you, I've got to have you. I submit that man is not really in search of himself, he's in love with himself. In fact, take a look at some of the Simon and Garfunkel records. In Dangling Conversation, I, my or mine, is used 15 times, and in I Am a Rock, 29 times. But you know, I have to be utterly honest with you. We have the philosophy of the I right inside the church, too. I'm reminded of the man who was going to a masquerade ball one night, and he was dressed up in a devil's costume. And his car was going along this country road. It was a slick, icy road late at night. And there was a thunderstorm going, and finally the car slipped into the ditch. He couldn't get the car out of the ditch, and so he crawled out of the wreckage, walked across the field, and came to a small country church where the people were having their evening prayer meeting. And just as he came to the door to open the door of the church, there was a bolt of lightning, a clap of thunder, the people looked around, and here was the devil. And they went out of the doors and windows as quickly as they could, except for one little old lady standing there scared stiff. And she said, Mr. Devil, I don't know what you want here, but I've got only one thing to say. I've been a member of this church for 40 years, but I've really been on your side all the time. And so, many of us perhaps are not on the right side. You remember the student at the University of Michigan a few years ago who flunked his exams? And so rather than go home and lose face, he hid in the bell tower of the local Methodist church. There were some strange sounds and goings on in that church. The spaghetti disappeared from the refrigerator. There were creakings and groanings in the church until it was discovered there had been a man hiding in the church. Whether you're a Protestant, Catholic, or a Jew, are you hiding in the church? I submit that for all of the people of whom I've been speaking, and those in religious groups too,
those just going through the motions. These approaches are not the answer to man's basic problems, anxiety, guilt, and hate. What is the answer? What's your answer? I would like to give you mine, candidly and fairly. I believe that man is a responsible being. I believe he is responsible to God, the God who made him. Remember how Job in the Old Testament said, "Show me my guilt, O God." And God didn't answer that question. Rather, he said, "Job, where were you when I created the world?" And this is the problem many have today. It's like the two college students. One says to the other, "What are you doing?" The other says, "Oh, I'm searching for God." And the other says, "Oh, is he lost again?" Somehow we think the good shepherd is lost and the sheep have to find him. I believe that man has broken God's laws, and I believe that only God can forgive man. And I believe that God has revealed himself to us, and he wants to forgive us. A sailor walked into the chaplain's office and said, "I'm an atheist." The chaplain said, "That's very interesting. Tell me what kind of a God you don't believe in." And for an hour he told him. And when the hour was over, the chaplain said, "You know, I think I must be an atheist too, because I don't believe in that God either." And then he told him about the God who loves and wants to forgive. In conclusion, Luigi Pirandello, the Italian dramatist, once wrote a fantastic little play called Six Characters in Search of an Author. In the play, a group of actors were assembled on a stage rehearsing a new play. And they were interrupted by the arrival of six characters who clamored to be produced. "We bring you a drama, sir," said one of the characters. "We are six most interesting characters, sir. However, we have been sidetracked." "Well, that's very interesting," said the stage manager, "but what do you want here, all of you?" "Why," came the repeated plea, "we want to live in you." Now, this idea of a character that wants to be brought to life and to actuality by being played out on the stage of life is a unique idea. What a tragedy when a person's life is like a half-finished block of marble in which the character never appeared. For me, Jesus Christ is the chief character in my life. What is it for you? No matter what your faith, I believe every person must come to grips with three basic questions. Who are you? Where are you going? What is your purpose in life? I believe that God will give you the answer to these questions, so that one day, when you are face to face with him, you will be able to receive from him your master's degree. W.D. Well done, thou good and faithful servant.
AFRTS has just presented a special program featuring Dr. Donald Deffner. Dr. Deffner will be speaking tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock at St. James of the Fishermen Episcopal Church and at 11:15 in the Naval Station Chapel. Your host for this program has been Chaplain W.R. Samuel, Naval Station Protestant Chaplain. Good night.